Thank you, Joel. My name's Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
When I walked in here yesterday, saw Joel and Jeff and John, it brought memories and Robert. Obviously. God, how did I forget Robert, for crying out? These guys have played a big part of my life, my program. Did I say I was an alcoholic? I don't ever want to forget that. What does that mean when I say I'm an alcoholic? It means if I take a drink of liquor, I have no idea what's going to happen. And I love that. I love that. I love crazy. The thing I love to do best is to get drunk and raise hell. And I raised all the hell I could raise till I couldn't, you know. But these guys have meant so much to me over the years in so many different ways. And it's strange because I've been talking all day to a lot of people. And I've run out of things to say. I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to talk about. I have an idea. They say our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. Well, I tell you what, you didn't want to know me when I was drinking. My dad sure didn't. God, dog. I never will forget when I started. When I came into the program, I couldn't read the book. I'd read a sentence, and by the time I got to the end of the sentence, I couldn't remember what the first word was. And I don't know what that disease is called. I call it alcoholism, but not everybody has that. Some of the people that I was around could read. I couldn't, and it took me a long time. But I remember when I finally was able to comprehend some of the book, I remember reading, it says, lack of power is our dilemma. And that hit me like a ton of bricks. Because when I was 16 years old, I started drinking when I was 13. I fell off the bar stool at the Wedgwood Inn at 13 years old. And almost knocked myself out on the floor, and they picked me up and put me back on the bar stool. I almost fell back down again, and I'm glad they didn't ask me for a driver's license. I had two driver's licenses, actually. I was 13. One of them said I was 18, and the other said I was 21. That got me in trouble later. Anyway. But I was getting ready to talk about going to college, and my dad wanted me to apply for college. And so I came down on Friday night. I had a date, and I was getting ready to go out. Dad said, have you filled out your college application yet? I said, no, not yet, but I'll do it tomorrow. He said, you've been telling me that for a year. And I said, well, I meant it for a year. I just haven't had time to do it yet. And he said to me, Bill, your only problem is you can't make yourself do what you need to do when you need to do it. And that absolutely, somebody could have shot me with a cannon and not hurt me any more than that. Because he described exactly how I felt about myself. You know, I didn't want to be a bad guy. I wanted to be a nice guy. But I was a bad guy. I wanted to be a good student, but I couldn't make myself study. I wanted to play on the football team, but I couldn't make myself go to practice. That stuff lives with you and goes over and over and over again. And after he said that, there's not been one day from that day to this I haven't thought about that. But when I read it in the book, I said, oh my God, lack of power, that is my dilemma. But what do you do about that? There is one who has all power. That was God. May you find him now. What a deal. What a deal. I finally did go to college. I went to college a lot. I went to almost every state school in Ohio. Except for, I didn't go to Kent State. I went to Miami University and flunked out. Got a 0.4, which I didn't have troubles going, you know, I had trouble going to class. I love college. I worked in a bar. You know, how could you know? I loved it, you know. And I went to Miami and flunked out the first time. They made me stay out a year. I went back and got thrown out the second time. Got in a little water fight. And so Dad was a little upset with me. But he was more upset with the school. My dad graduated 4.0 in business administration from Miami University. In fact, I had one of the professors that he had. And so Dad came down to see me, and I wasn't at the dorm, and he didn't know where I was, so he decided to see his old professor, because he knew that, Dad knew that I had his class. So Dad goes in and talks to the guy, and he said, well, you know my son Bill Jr. He said, who? And that's when he found that I wasn't going to class. And he got upset about that. But when they threw me out, he got madder at the university than did at me, and he went back down and got the guy fired and threw me out. Because my dad loved me, and he wanted to take care of me, and he wanted good things for me. He was a physician. So I was embarrassed about that. And I said, Dad, please don't get that guy thrown out. That's not his fault. He said, as far as I'm concerned, it is. And so I couldn't go back to Miami. So I decided I'd go to a little college in Dayton, Sinclair College, which is a two-year college. And I did pretty well because I was paying for it myself. It makes a difference if you're paying for it. And then I did pretty well in that. I went to University of Cincinnati, and I'm kind of proud of my team today, but I wasn't proud. They weren't good when I went there. But I went down to UC and found out that the draft board is after me. And so I decided I would enlist in the Air Force, which I did. And I got married when I was in the Air Force first year, had to. I was a little bit embarrassed about having to get married, but I liked the gal, you know, and she was pretty and very good dancer. And so we got married and she had the baby, and Hank, that's my oldest son, William Henry Freeze III. And 29 days later, I left for Vietnam. And I spent 363 days there and came home. I didn't think I was coming home. I can remember being there, but it's been so long ago that I forgot how frightened I was, but I was scared to death. And because I didn't want to die. I'd gotten to a place where I didn't want to die. So anyway, but my wife and I weren't getting along too well because I worked at the flight line at night and I worked at the Airman's Club during the day every other day, tent and bar. Now that's about the best thing. If you're going to be in Vietnam, that's about the best way to go. And I got drunk every day over there, every day. Beer cost a quarter, and I didn't even pay for it, you know, because I was a bartender. And I really got used to drinking every day. And when I came home, I don't know if you saw American Sniper, but if you did, there's a scene in there where he has come back and he's sitting in the bar in the United States. And his wife called him, said, "Where are you?" He said, "I'm home. I'm in a bar." She said, "Why are you there? Why are you there?" He said, "Because I can't come home yet." And I was scared to come home because I didn't know what was going to be there. We weren't getting along. I didn't know her. I didn't know Hank, my son. I didn't know anything. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I had 6 months left to serve, and I didn't know what I was going to do. So we went to, I was stationed at the Cape Cod at Otis Air Base. And I had made rank when I was over there, so I was a staff sergeant. And I drank all the time up there. I mean, it was just crazy. And my wife then said, "Why are you drinking so much?" And I said, "I don't know." And she said, what's wrong, Bill? And I said, "I don't know. But I feel better when I'm drunk than I do when I'm not." And she said, "Well, this can't go on." She said, "I want you to stop." And I said, "I want me to stop too, but I don't know how." So I got out of the service and came back to Dayton. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, and I came back to Dayton and finished my associate degree and got a job, and we went to Toledo, Ohio, and then on to Detroit, Michigan. I got a promotion, went to Detroit, Michigan, and Detroit, my job was, is to entertain 32 customers every week. Oh my God. And one day I had gotten so drunk the night before, and I had to go to work because I couldn't miss a day. God, if I miss a day, I'd have to catch up, you know, entertaining all these people. And I was going down the Lodge Freeway, which is the largest freeway at that time in Detroit, going 85 miles an hour with cars 4 inches from me on all four sides. And I had a panic attack. I know now what it was, but what it was, I couldn't look to the right or to the left or down or up, and I couldn't see. My eyes started getting screwed up, and I thought, what the hell am I going to do? So I turned on the blinker and started to turn right to get off the road. And if somebody beeped, I'd straighten up, but I couldn't look. And so I finally got off the road, and cops came, and I said, something's wrong with me. And so they called my wife and said, "Come get him." And she took me to the hospital and found out it was just a panic attack. That's all it was, but I thought I was going to die. Now, my father had moved to Hilton Head Island, and he was the second doctor on the island and very much respected. Now, he and I didn't get along at all. But whenever I need help, I'm not afraid to call him. Because, you know, I have no pride. And so I call him up and I said, Dad, I don't know what's going on, but I'm having this going on. I talked to him and he said, why don't you come down here and let's talk, see what we can do. So my family and I had another child in Toledo, so I had two children. And we go down to Hilton Head. And while I was down there, somebody offered me a job. So I took it. And it was doing the same thing I was doing in Detroit, but it was, you know, it's got to be easier at Hilton Head than it would be in Detroit. So I got a company car and started trying to make sales calls. Now, I have a little trouble because I'm afraid of people, see, and I'm in sales, all right? So it's kind of hard to sell stuff if you're driving down the street throwing catalogs out the window, you know? And that's what I was doing down there. And I had a territory that was doing pretty well until I took it over. And finally, the guy says, what's wrong, Bill? You're not making calls. I said, I know. And he said, I'm going to have to let you go. And I said, thank you very much. I never wanted to get out of anything in my life as bad as I did that. And so I had some friends down there that owned a big company called the Hilton Head Company, and they hired me to run a marina. Now, if you're an alcoholic, running the marina is a very good job. And my wife almost lost her mind. Because I could drink all day, every day. And did. And so we had a little trouble in our marriage. And she said, if you don't change, I'm going to have to leave. And I said, well, I'm trying to change, but I don't seem to be able to, so I guess you're going to have to leave. So we got a divorce, and she moved. Now, this is called a divorce, okay? We lived at Hilton Head Island, and she moved to Colorado Springs, Colorado, and which is good for her because I didn't visit her. She didn't want me around. And so I got married again, and that one lasted 13 months. I say it lasted almost all the way out of the church, which is really a better saying because it was doomed from the beginning. And I loved the girl, but she was so crazy that, you know, we just damn near drank ourselves to death. And so her parents came down and said that if I'd sign these papers, they'd give me a bunch of money to leave her alone. And I said, I don't want your money. But obviously my life has fallen apart. So I decided that Hilton Head was killing me. So I moved to Atlanta, got a job selling Charles chips. And I had a chips truck. I don't know if you know what Charles chips is, but I was driving this big yellow truck around with chips and pretzels and cheese and all that stuff, and driving around, dropping them off, you know. And by this time, I was drinking a half a gallon a day of vodka. And my kids came to visit me, and they would go with me, see, and they would go sell the stuff. And they loved it. They absolutely loved it. And I remember Hank, my oldest son, saying, you know, Dad has the only briefcase that gurgles. And so I lost that job because I ran over so many mailboxes that I lost my insurance on a truck, so I couldn't work for him anymore. And I got a job again with the company I originally worked for in Toledo in Detroit. And I don't know how I got that job. I do not remember going on the interview. I was a bad blackout drinker. And anyway, so I get this job, and I'm working for the same guy I worked for in Detroit. And he was now a zone manager, and then I worked for his underling in the Atlanta office. And I was drinking every day. And I think this is funny. I was a blackout drinker, and one day the national sales manager for this company, and this is a Pitney Bowes company. I mean, this is no child's play. It was a big company, a good company. And the national sales manager for Monarch, is who I work for, came down to travel with me. And I was nervous, and I remember getting up and partly going to work, but that's when I went in a blackout. And I wake up at 2:30 in the afternoon over somewhere in Marietta driving the car, and he was in there beside me. And we've been making sales calls all day long. And I didn't know where we'd been. I didn't know where we were going. I didn't know what we'd done. And I thought, what the hell am I going to do? And I don't know what made me say this, but I says, well, what do you think? And he said, I think you're doing great. And I said, me too, man, me too. And he said, you know, I'm satisfied with what's going on down here. We probably need to go back to the office. I had no idea where we were. And I thought to myself, how do you get out of this? So I said, you know, the rumor in the company is that you have the best set of direction in the world. And I wonder if that's really true. He said, I'll show you. Let me drive. And he drove us back to the office. No idea. No idea that I'd been drunk and in a blackout. How, does God take care of drunks and fools or what? So about 3 weeks after that, I go into the office and I ask my boss a question. And he said, Bill, this is on Friday. He said, Bill, you asked me that on Wednesday. You asked me that yesterday, and the answer hasn't changed. So get out of my office. Well, I didn't know what the answer was because I don't remember that, see? And I said, I think I'm in trouble. And I think they were starting to suspect something, you know? So the product manager for the product I was selling came to travel with me to see why my customers weren't buying, not why I wasn't selling them, why they weren't buying. Because, see, I was lying to them. I'd love to have read talk about lying. I didn't even know the truth. You know, I could. And so I picked him up at the airport, and I said, I'll pick you up in the morning, and we'll go make some calls. So I did what I always did. I got up at 5:30 in the morning. By 6, I had my three-piece suit on, ready to go to work. And I was sitting on my threadbare couch with my half gallon of vodka trying to get drunk enough to go. And I couldn't get drunk enough to go. I couldn't walk out that door. And I thought, what am I going to do? Now, that was a moment of terror, the first moment of terror, worst I've ever had. I hope it is the worst I ever had. And I thought, what are you going to do, Bill? So I called him and I said, I got a little problem at the bank. He said, well, definitely take care of that. I got some work to do. When you get it finished, pick me up and we'll go make some calls. So it gave me time, see. So I got in the car with my vodka and my briefcase and started driving around. He's staying at the North Lake Hilton, if you know Atlanta at all. And I was driving around the North Lake Hilton, just driving around, waiting. And circle kept getting bigger and bigger. And about 2 o'clock that afternoon, I said, Bill, you're in trouble. Because I was still driving around. And I needed some help. And I don't know what to do. So I decided to be sick. And I need to prove that I'm sick. And so I decided to check into the hospital. And that's good proof, you know. And I was driving down Briarcliff Road. Well, there happens to be a hospital on Briarcliff Road. It's called the Georgia Mental Health Institute. So I pull in there and went up to the admission desk and I said, told them what I needed to do. I need to get in here. And they said, what do you want in here for? I said, well, I have a little problem with drinking. And they said, when did you have your last drink? I said, I didn't know I had. That's kind of scary, you know. They said, well, we can't let you in here if you've had a drink in the last 6 hours. I said, I got news for you. If I could go with the 6 hours without a drink, I wouldn't be standing here talking to you, for God's sake. They said, we can't let you in, man. No matter what, we can't let you in. You'll have to come back. So I don't know why, but I took a taxi home. Left the company car there. And I knew these people. This company is a good company, and they care about their people. And I knew they were going to come find out what was wrong, because I didn't show up. I never did call him. So I decided I'd put everything I had from that company in a box. And when they showed up, they would knock on the door. I would open the door, shove the box in their face, say, I hate frickin' job, and I quit, and then slam the door. So I got everything I had from that company in this box and waited. All of a sudden, big knock on the door. Opened the door, picked up the box, said, I hate the frickin' job. I quit. And my boss said, Bill, what's wrong? And I started to cry. I said, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what's wrong, but I can't quit drinking. He said, Bill, you need to take care of this. You need to do what you need to do to take care of this. I love you too much to see you die. And he meant that. Now, he was with his boss and his boss. There were three of them there. And they all three were good to me. So I knew how to get in there. See, you don't have to tell them the truth. You know, they say, when did you have your last drink? I said, yesterday. Which is almost true, you know. So I got in there. And my blood pressure looked like the national debt. I mean, it was so high. And they were scared to death I was going to die. They really were. And they gave me this stuff to kind of calm me down. And it worked. The third day I was in there, 15 days. The third day I was in there, when you get up in the morning, you have to go to breakfast. It's downhill, see? And I walk out, and I look down that hill, and I thought, do you think I'd have walked down there or rolled down? you know, I was, this stuff was crazy and it's driving me nuts. I don't like that drug feeling, see? And so I went and I told him, I said, take me off this medication. I don't like it. I don't like it. And so they said, okay, we'll do that. Well, about 2 o'clock in the morning or in the afternoon, I rethought that because I was jittery, you know, going nuts, and but I couldn't. They wouldn't give me any more, so I had to tough it out. But anyway, I got out of there, didn't lose my job, because AA had sobered up a guy in the company 5 years before, and he'd become a good member of the company and a good member of AA. So they gave AA a chance to let me keep my job. But they said, if you don't, when I left the GMHI, they said, if you don't go to a meeting tonight, we're going to tell your employer. I said, oh God, I don't want to do that. You know, I got to go. So I go to Clarkston and met a guy named Jim Lowry, who's passed away now. But I walked in the door. He said, you knew? I said, no, hell no. I've been sober 15 days. And he says, I want you to get half a cup of coffee and sit down. And I thought, that's kind of dumb. What the hell would I want a half a cup of coffee for? Well, about halfway through the meeting, I found out why I had a half a cup of coffee, because I was shaking like I was shaking bad. I have a term for that, but I can't say it in here. And after the meeting, he said, you got any questions? I said, yeah, I got a lot of them. He said, well, we're going to answer them. He said, I'll be your sponsor if you're willing to work the steps. And I said, well, what are the steps? He said, Bill, it doesn't matter. If you're not willing to go to any length to get this deal, you'll be wasting my time and yours. And I thought, this guy's serious. And he set a tone for me in AA that I'm so grateful for, because there's no free lunches in here. There are no free lunches. And so he said, I'm going to assign you to two people. One of them was a guy named Leon Sears, who's passed away now, and another guy named Mac. And I said, what do I need to do? He said, you need to call him every day. You need to go to one meeting a day, and you need to call him every day. Tell him how you're doing. And if you miss a day, you're going to have to start over again. I said, okay. Well, I liked Leon, but I didn't like Mac much. So every once in a while I'd miss him. And Mac was nice enough, he didn't tell on me. So anyway, and after the meeting, we would go over to his house and sit around the coffee table and talk about working the steps. And that's all we talked about. And there's like 10 guys there. And I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed being a part of that group. I got to tell you a story about Mac, okay? We used to have a meeting called the Memorial Drive Beginners Group, or they call it the Rock. It was at the Rock of Ages Lutheran Church. And I'd had a bad day, see, and I walk in, and here stands Mac. And he said, God, I'm glad to see you. And I thought, you know, Mac is intuitive. He knows I've had a bad day, and he wants me to feel welcome. And I said, well, thank you, Mac. And he said, now I'm not the sickest son of a bitch here. And that's the way we treated each other. And I loved it. I loved that. Jim came over one Wednesday and he said, Bill, I realize that you can't read. or you can, but you don't get anything out of it. So I'm going to come over this Wednesday and I'm going to tell you how I work the steps. So he came over Wednesday night and I made some coffee and we sat down and he started telling me how he worked the steps. Not how I ought to work them, but how he worked them. He showed me the way. If there's anything I wish I'd have taped, it would be that. It was the most beautiful story I've ever heard about working the steps. And I thought, I'm ready to do this, Jim. And I said, when do you think I ought to be ready to take my fourth step? He said, when you're ready to feel better. I said, ready to feel? I've been ready to feel better for a couple of months. What do you think? He said, if you're ready to feel better, I want you to go down and write the six things you vowed you'd never tell anybody, and the rest is easy. So I did that. I went home, and there were six things. Now, how he knew that, I never know. But there were six things. And we worked on that inventory, worked on it, and at about 4.5 months, I was ready to share it. And I go over there and I thought, now these six things, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I got to slide these on by him because I don't want him to hear them, see? Because he had a daughter that was about, you know, pretty girl, you know? And I had figured out by now that I can't get sober without Lowry. And if he finds out about this sex stuff I got on this inventory, man, he'll never let me in his house again. You know, I mean, this is serious stuff. And so he would walk over and get a cup of coffee, and I'd let one of them out, see? And then he'd come back, sit down, I'd start going again, and he went over to get another cup of coffee, and I let another one out. And he said, Freezy, I can hear just as well this coffee pot as I can over there. So just get done with it, get them out. And I did. And I went home. And that was the greatest first time in my program that I felt a part of. The words made sense. The words meant more. Love. I understood love a little bit better. And I fear and all that stuff, I understood a little bit better. And I fell apart of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the cool thing about this is that every time I go through that process, which is, I try to do it about once a year, every time I go through that process, it happens over again. You know, I can get out there crazy. Joel can tell you. All these guys can tell you. I can get out there as crazy as Betsy Bug. But there's a way back, and that's the only way I know that is through those steps, is to work those darn steps. So that's the good news, okay? Now, I have a little trouble with relationships. Like Lowry said, you don't marry well, but you marry a lot. And he'd say, you know, Freeze, you don't think well, but you think a lot. And I hated that. I hated that. I wanted to be a nice guy. I just don't know how. I don't want to lie, but I know how to do that. And so Jim, I was talking to Jim about it. I went over and spent some time one day about two things. One of them was the 10th step and the 11th step. And I said, Jim, it says in there, in the 10th step, but by this time, sanity will have returned. And I said, all I hear in meetings is about you have an alcoholic mind. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, that's not having sanity returned. He said, Bill, you're too eager. It takes time for this to happen. And he said, you've been sober about 10 months now. You want to be 20 years sober in 10 minutes, and it don't go that way. And I said, okay, I'll go along with that. But what about this God's will thing? And he said, let me tell you how I feel about that. He said, if you're really trying to do God's will, I believe that God will give you the power to do that. If you're trying to do God's will, he'll give you the power to carry it out. And I said, you really believe that, don't you? He said, I believe it, but that's my experience. He said, it doesn't say anything there about being happy about it. It says, give you the power to carry it out. And he said, Billy, you've been sober almost 11 months. You have had the power to carry it out. You just don't even know it. You have no idea what's going on. You have no idea what's going on. All you do is you want your wife back. You don't care which one. You know, I mean, and I said, do I have a chance, Jim? He said, yeah, you have a chance. You have a chance. What time is it? Oh, shoot. I am so glad to be here. You have made me feel so welcome here. This is such a good place. I've talked to my wife 6 times today. We've been married 27 years. We have 12 grandchildren that are really ours, and about 8 more that I've adopted, or we've adopted. And I've got to tell you about a story about those people. When I married Pat, I had given up on the fact, I'd been in therapy for 6 years. I got my third divorce almost killed me. And I couldn't even breathe when she said, I'm going to set you free. I didn't want to be free. You know, and I didn't want a divorce. I don't like divorce. You'd think I did, but I don't, you know. And so I went into therapy. My big sponsor, John H., who's dead now, but he was sober a long, long time. And he pointed me out to a counselor, and I went for 5 years into therapy. And I got released from therapy, and she said, I think you may have a chance now. You may be able to have a relationship, because I was working on inventories and all that stuff, driving myself crazy. And all of a sudden, so I'm moving back to Atlanta, and I got introduced to my now wife by Lindsay and Richard Gabe, who you don't know, but they were good friends of ours. Lindsay's dead, but Richard's still alive. They said, I want to introduce you to Pat. And God damn, she's pretty. I mean, woo! And I said, Lindsay, are you sure you want to do this to her? I mean, really? I don't have good luck in this stuff. And she said, you're going to be all right, Freezy. You're going to be all right. And so we decided we'd go out a little bit. And she's a runner. And I was a runner back then, too. And so We trained and ran 3 marathons. Now, if you want to get to know somebody, train to run a marathon with them, because you find out a lot about how they're doing. So the first time we ever ran together, we were at Stone Mountain, and we started, and I said, stop. I said, Pat, I'm in AA. She said, I figured you probably would, you know. And I said, well, does that scare you? And she said, it'd scare me a lot less if you were drinking. And so that was all right. So I passed that test, and we started running together. And Lowry met her. He was dying, and I wanted him to meet her before he died. So we go over there, and I said, Jim, this is Pat. Jim and Helen, his wife, this is Pat. And I really like this girl. And Jim says, I can see why. She's a keeper. And then he looked at Pat and says, pardon me. He said, don't take no shit off that son of a bitch. I said, well, that's a nice way to start this, you know. But he loved her. And then I introduced her to my other sponsor, who is John H. John said, Bill, I hate to tell you, but she's going to get through to your inside. She's going to see what's inside of you. That scared me to death. Because as long as I'd been sober, and it was a while at that time, I still didn't like what was in here. I still didn't like me very well. And I was doing some things that I shouldn't be doing, and not doing some things I should, and I was just not doing well, you know. So I was having trouble getting this God thing. And so I was working at Home Depot at the time, and I quit Home Depot because it was too hard on me, physically too hard. And I quit, and I started Grandpa Daycare. And so one of the grandkids, Drew, who was 2 and a half, who's now 15, her mom called me up and said, Bill, I can't do it today. I just can't handle her today. And she was really screwed up. I mean, having trouble, crazy, you know, and fighting. They were fighting and everything. And I said, I'll be over to get her in just a minute. And went and got her, and she didn't want to go with me. And she made that well known, but I had no choice. I had to take her because her mom didn't want her right there. Not that she didn't want her, she just couldn't handle her today. So I put her in the car and buckled her up and got in the car and started backing out, and she quit crying. And so I was talking to her driving down the road. We're going down the Peachtree Industrial Boulevard. And I said to her, I says, what does red light mean? She said, stop. I said, what does green light mean? She said, go. And I said, what does that say? She said, stop. Now what does that say? She said, go. And we were laughing like crazy, having fun going down Peachtree Industrial Boulevard. And I could see her in the mirror. And I thought to myself, you know, Bill, there's nothing that little girl could do to run you off. There is nothing she can do to run you off. I love that little girl with everything I had. And I love the rest of them too that way. And there's nothing those kids can do to run me off. And then I got to thinking about that. You know, if what you tell me in AA is true, and I'm one of God's kids, what makes me think I can run God off? Think about that. That's what I've been trying to do. I am so grateful to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be a part of you all. I told you I called Pat 6 times today. I am a creature of habit. I feel better when I'm wearing things that belong to other people, like, or that other people have given me, like these shoes and these socks and this shirt that I have on under this shirt. Pat gave me all those. And I wear them because I feel closer to God when I have them on. Now that probably doesn't make any sense to anybody else. But I tell you what, I don't want anything to take this away from me. Anything. As a result of being a part of this family that I'm in, Pat's mom developed dementia. I didn't like Pat's mom at all. In fact, I almost told her one time never to call our house again because she would rail on Pat so hard. But I was the only one that, I was running Grandpa daycare, but I had time when she got sick, I had time to take care of her. So I became her caregiver. And I joined a group of caregivers for people with dementia. Now, when I walked into AA, I didn't feel comfortable at first, but I feel very comfortable in AA. There's not a meeting I go to I don't feel comfortable in. But when I walked into that dementia group, I couldn't believe it. I felt comfortable from the get-go. See, I don't know what I'm going to do with this woman. I don't like her. And I got to take care of her. Now, what the hell do you do? How do you do that? And so I started bringing her breakfast, a cup of coffee, and sit down and talk to her. I said, Grandma, what are you thinking about? And she's always thinking about something. She's like me, thinking 100 miles an hour. And she'd say, well, I'm thinking about when I lived in Florida, I'm thinking about this and that. And we'd talk, and she could remember back then, but she couldn't remember yesterday. But that doesn't bother me. I'd just soon talk about a long time ago than yesterday. It doesn't bother me at all. Now, it drove her, Pat's brothers and sisters crazy. You know, they'd say, well, Grandma, can't you remember that? Well, that isn't what you tell them. No, they don't. If they could remember, they would. They can't. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but I'm telling you, dementia makes absolutely no sense. And so I got to be a part of these people's lives. And I got to do another thing. I'm not doing it anymore, but I got to facilitate a group of what they call early stage diagnosis people. In other words, people know they have dementia and they're dealing with it. And I saw love, true love, every time we met for each other. Now, here's this guy, he's got Lewy body dementia. That doesn't mean anything probably to anybody, but that means you're scared all the time and you see things and hear things that aren't there. Now, how scary is that, you know? So this guy walks in, he's scared to death. And he tells the group, he said, I'm scared to death. And this guy in the group says, Mark, God's been taking care of you for 50 years. Do you think he's going to give up on you now? This guy had dementia. And he figured that out. It took me 40 years in Alcoholics Anonymous to figure that out. Well, not all 40, but close, you know. I mean, and I thought to myself, what a deal. What an honor. I know that probably doesn't make any sense, but see, that's a part of my life today. I get to do things that I never dreamed I'd be able to do. What did Lowry say? God will give you the power to carry it out. And he has. I have a prayer that I say every day, at least once a day. And it has to do with this, and it has to do with a prayer that Jim Williams said about a relationship that he had. So my prayer today is, God, please show me your will and give me the power to carry it out. And remove my defects so I can better serve you and others. Thy will for Pat as well as for me. Take our relationship and make it the way you want it to be and show me the truth. And that has stood me in good stead for a lot of time. John, thanks for asking me to do this. I hope I made some sense. I love y'all, and you can't do a goddamn thing about it.